I want to speak this afternoon on the subject of discipline. And there is a passage of Scripture that I would like to direct your attention to, found again in the book of Ephesians, chapter 6. Ephesians tells you how to live a heavenly life in a hell-like world. The last three chapters of this book are God's orthopedics clinic. They tell you how to walk when there's a war on. You have a series of relationships, relationships that create responsibility, relationships between the husband and the wife, between the wife and the husband, between children and their parents. And in verse 4, between parents and children. Here we read, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the chastening and the admonition of the Lord." Now, it's a manifest fact that most of us are creatures of extreme. We are always suffering from the peril of the pendulum. Nowhere is this more evident than in the area of discipline with children. With many a Christian parent, he's faced with the problem of over-discipline. He conceives of his role as that of a Simon Legree. Every time the kid turns around, he nails him to the floor, makes a federal case out of every issue. And he does it often under very sincere but erroneous compunctions. He thinks, now that I have become a believer, I'm going to have to make up for all of those years when I was out to lunch. And it's very interesting. Some fathers who were excellent fathers become very poor fathers when they come to faith. And they develop an uneducated conscience. And they decide that they're going to have to settle everything, right? There and then. I have worked for a number of years as a consultant with the juvenile department of the city of Dallas, and it's amazing how many children we run into whose parents are guilty of over-discipline. I was out with a squad car one night. The officer and I found a boy unconscious by the side of the road. And we counted 64 major welts on that kid's body. He had been beaten into unconsciousness by his father. And when we accosted him, the first thing his father wanted us to know was that he was a disciplinarian. The truth of the matter is, he doesn't know beans about what it means to be a disciplinarian. Because the only thing he knows how to do is to over-discipline a child. Well, then the pendulum swings to the other side, and you get under-discipline. You get an ultra-permissive parent who, in effect, says, "Don't touch your child. You'll destroy his psyche. Johnny wants to throw a brick through a plate glass window. Don't stop him. You'll curb his genius for throwing bricks." Someone asked Grady Wilson years ago, "Did your mother ever spank you?" He said, "Did she ever spank me? She had a strap in the kitchen that hung underneath the motto, 'I need thee every hour.'" Now, the interesting thing is this. Over-discipline and under-discipline produce exactly the same product. They produce insecurity. And if you are to visit any juvenile hall here in the area and go through the files, you can essentially classify all parents of delinquent children in one of these two extremes, either over-discipline or under-discipline. But a child who has standards, who has parameters for behavior, who knows exactly what his parents will let him do and not do, and at the same time, who is consistently loved, never shows up as a delinquent child. But if he's over-disciplined or if he's under-disciplined, then you're in trouble. And that's why Paul says, stop provoking your children to wrath. This is a very interesting construction in the Greek text. It can be translated one of two ways. Either he is saying, stop provoking your children to wrath, or he could be saying, don't get the habit of provoking your children to wrath. If you're doing it, cut it out. If you're not doing it, don't ever start. And people constantly ask, how do you provoke your children to wrath? My friend, you provoke them to wrath by over-discipline that's arbitrary, that's a process of venting your spleen. Or you provoke them to wrath by under-discipline so that the child grows up an undisciplined person and knows that the most significant people in his life sold him down the river. Now look at the last part of that verse. Stop provoking your children to wrath. But here's the biblical alternative. Bring them up. How do you bring them up? Well, the text says, first of all, in the correction, and secondly, in the admonition of the Lord. Every good physician practices two forms of medicine. He practices preventive medicine, and he practices corrective medicine. And every good parent practices two forms of discipline. Corrective discipline and preventive discipline. Let's see if I can illustrate these for you in terms of relationship. Let's draw ourselves a square. And let's label it preventive discipline. At the center of this square, let's put a circle. And let's label it corrective discipline. Let's look at the relationship between these two. What is it that determines the effectiveness of your corrective discipline? It's the context of your preventive discipline. For example, I ask you, do you play with your child? See, if you don't play with your child, you have no right to spank him. Oh, you say, but I'm his parent. I can do anything I want. Certainly you can. But you can't guarantee the result. And sometimes the only time a child gets attention is when he misbehaves. When's the last time you played with him? I mean, you chose to play with him. For instance, you come home from work at night, your wife says, honey, meal will be about 10 minutes. You say to your boy, hey, buddy, what would you like to do? He says, hey, Dad, could we go out and throw the ball around? You better believe it, man. Meet me outside, get the ball. We go out, we toss that ball around, we have a fantastic time. Pretty soon, Mom calls for supper. Good. Night, that's the fastest 10 minutes I spent today. We'll have to get back on that. Yeah, that's right, Dad. Yeah. He thinks you're a winner. But see what happens, these seminars, you know, everybody comes, they get all shook up. That's right, Brother Nick. Thank you for telling me. We go home this afternoon and say, all right, come on, son, let's go, play ball. Hendrick says I'm supposed to play ball with you. Come on. Come on now, hurry up. I don't have a lot of time to horse around. You know, you get the ball, boom, boom, right through the middle of it. There are 101 places you'd rather be than playing ball with him. You know where you might as well be? Any one of the 101. you are only communicating negatively to him. I'm playing ball with you because that's what I'm supposed to do. We're talking about, I want to play ball with you because there's nothing else I'd rather do. And one of the things that you ought to say, you ought to do with your child, particularly as he grows up, is to spend increasingly more chunks of time. See, when a child is very small, he needs a lot of little bits of time. And that's why your little kid, you know, will be running across the floor and you'll sweep him up off his feet and toss him up in the air. When he comes down, you catch him and lather him with kisses and put him down. Never loses a step. That's why your kid will look up and say to you, Mommy, what's my name? And you say, Son, you're acting like your father. If he is, his father is sheer brilliant. Your small child is not asking you for information. He's asking for your attention. He's asking for that great, big, almighty you to bend down and look him straight in the eye and say, Billy! Okay. You listen to your child? Please note, I'm not asking you, do you talk to your child? I know the answer to that. I mean, do you listen? Very few parents do, particularly with teenagers. They're tone deaf. Where you stop and say, I really want to hear. I'm interested. You fix your kid's bicycle tire, doll buggy. Boy, I had a beautiful experience with a kid who came in to see me. He said to me, Boy, my dad's for real. I said, Really? How do you know that? He said, Would you believe? He said, I came in the other night. He gave me a 12 o'clock curfew. And about a mile and a half from our house, that bomb broke down. I drive. And he said, I couldn't get it to move. And so I finally got some guys and we pushed it a mile and a half home. And I got in about 12:45 and he said, I went into his room and I said, Dad, he said, I'm here. I said, well, great. Yeah, but it's late. Well, what happened? Oh, he said, the car went out. What's the matter with it? I said, I don't know. He said, well, let's go see. I'll meet you out in the garage. He said, would you believe it was 3:30 in the morning and the guy's underneath the bomb fixing the transmission? You know what, my friend? That father said more to that son and created a greater context for discipline than 20 forms of correction. He said, I really care about what you care about. Or I would also ask you in this type of thing, do you spend time with your child? Please note, I don't mean amount. There's people who get all covered over with guilt. Oh, boy, should be spending more time. Not necessarily. If it's very poor time, you better spend less. Don't multiply the mediocrity. And by the way, your kid isn't hung up over the fact that you don't spend more time with him. What he's hung up over is the fact that you never choose to spend your time with him. You never say to him, hey, buddy, what would you like to do? And he says, hey, Dad, can we go fishing? Sure, man, next Saturday morning, we're going to carve it out. We'll get up early. We'll get the gear all together. See, that's time that you chose to spend with him. Now, please note, who is it that spanks me? Who is it that punishes me in any form? I'll tell you who it is, the man who plays with me, the man who listens to me. The man who fixes my bicycle tire. The man who, of his own volition, chooses to spend his time with me. Well, that's an altogether different person that corrects me than the person who never gives me any attention except to warm my bottom and to ream me out. Let me illustrate this for you. We have a strange mother in our home. She takes a dim view of our wrestling in the living room. Can you imagine any woman? And so she throws us out. And some time ago, my younger son and I got in a wrestling match in the living room, and we got tossed out on our ear. And we landed in the backyard, and he got me in a hole. So I decided I would teach him how to break the hole. And so I pivoted, but I pivoted too far and too fast. And old Bill comes off like a missile going across the yard. You've had this experience? Boy, you know, and you grab yourself. Oh, it's going to be a concussion. They'll try me for child battering. He goes flying across the yard, bounces on the ground, gets up. Boy, Dad, that was terrific. Do it again. Now, that's the same kid that you can go like this, and he dissolves in tears, because it has nothing to do with force. It has everything to do with relationship. What kind of a relationship do you have with your child? Now, let me take this truth and give you a couple negatives and a couple positives. First of all, some negatives. There are two words I'm always careful never to use. Those words are always and never. And I'd like to suggest some things you ought always never use. Number one, don't use comparison of children with children. Bobby, why are you like that? Why aren't you good like Billy? There's one intelligent answer. I'm not Billy. You know, we've got four children, all the product of the same combination of genes, and no two of them are alike. I can't motivate them alike, could never discipline them alike. But you see, that's what most people are looking for, a patent medicine approach to this. What are the five things you always do under every circumstance that will always produce this kind of a product? If you ever find that person, don't believe them. You are not dealing with machines, you're dealing with people. And you've got to gear the entire educational process to this child at this particular stage. And there are some children at this particular juncture who need a very firm hand. And there are other children, or even the same child, at a different stage of development that need some developmental rope, that need to be given more freedom and encouraged to make their own decisions. Second, don't make fun of weaknesses. Now, this happens to be the genius of the male of the species. He's the master with the needle, and usually he's had considerable opportunity to work his wife over. He's the one that goes by the mirror while she's putting on her makeup and says, well, that's an exercise in futility. You know, which really motivates you no end. So by the time Junior arrives, you know, he's got a lot of this venom, a lot of experience with it. And there's one thing I would recommend for you that you can eliminate with no regret, and that's sarcasm. Sarcasm with a child is like pouring sulfuric acid. It's lethal to the system. And I ask people over and over again, are you on this kid's back or are you on his team? You need to get off his back and get on his team. A student came into my office some time ago. He said, "Prof, I think I'm going to check it to you." I said, "You what?" He said, "Yeah, I'm thinking of leaving." I said, "You got to be kidding." He said, "I've never been more truthful." I said, "What in the world are you leaving for?" He said, "I really don't think I have it for the ministry." And my friends, I had the hardest time to keep from roaring in his face. Well, I thought to myself, if I ever tell the rest of the student body you don't have it, they'll all be headed for the registrar's office to resign. This kid has about 162 IQ, which is slightly above average. This kid is an honors graduate of a leading Ivy League school, had a Rhodes Scholarship. This guy is an absolute genius and a tremendously effective worker with people. I said, "Tell me something about your family." "Oh," he said, "that's a bad scene." I said, "Well, give me some detail." "Well," he said, "my father had one favorite name for me, and that was Dummy. I'd come home from school with a 98, he'd say, "Well, where are the other 2 points?" He said, "In fact, I can never remember once in my life having my father say, 'Son, it's a good job. I'm proud of you.'" Ladies and gentlemen, if you spend 18 years being called dummy by the most important people in your life, you begin to believe them. And it really makes very little difference what the facts are. That's exactly how he feels. And the interesting thing is, it comes out of the finest Christian homes that people keep talking about, where we have these unrealistic standards, where we're trying to pour a kid into a mold of perfectionism, where we're suffering from a fog of moralism, where we never really enjoy life, and we're constantly picking at this kid for every single thing that we think is wrong. Could be better. By the way, if you want to know how you're doing on that, you better run a tape recorder in your home someday. Run it all day long. Find out how many times you affirm your child by saying, "Wonderful, son. I'm so proud of you. Oh, that was so thoughtful, son, picking up that wrench. Man, I appreciate that. Great having a guy like you around." Third, don't be afraid to say no. You know, that's the hardest word to get adults to say. I have adults in my office whose children are involved with the law for delinquent behavior. And here are two, you know, college graduates. I mean, you figure they got enough marbles to at least get something together. And they sit there in front of you. I had one not too long ago. He's about 6 feet, 5 inches tall. You know, could have wrapped me around a pole 3 times. And I said to him, "Why didn't you tell your boy no?" "Well," he said, I was afraid." I said, "You're afraid of what?" "Well," he said, I was afraid of what he'd think." I really couldn't bring myself to tell him what his kid really thinks. He told me what he thinks. I don't think he's really prepared to choke that down. He said, "I was afraid I'd lose him." I said, "Looks to me like you've done a pretty good job of that." I said, "Let me ask you a question. What would you have said to him had you told him?" And he went right down and gave me a very intelligent explanation. I said, "Man, friend, that's exactly what I would have told my child. Why didn't you tell him?" Afraid. Men and women, write it down deep in your mind. If you love your child, you will discipline him. And if you don't discipline him, you don't love him.
We have this crazy idea of love that, you know, you're never going to hurt anybody.
My closest friend who, you know, he just loves to operate on me. He just thinks this is his favorite indoor sport. Just finished slicing me up. Some time ago, I'd been to him before, and I had some pains down here. And he said, well, we better take some pictures. And he took some pictures. He said, Hendricks, you get a rock collection down there. And since you're not a geologist, we better remove them. I said, well, what are the odds? Oh, I said, about 90-10. About 90-10. Spell that out. Oh, he said, about 90% you won't live unless we take them out. About 10% you will. You know, I like a guy that sort of tells it like it is. And would you believe that guy sliced me here about that long? And he never shed a tear? He never said, Howie, I hate to tell you this, but I'm going to have to cut you. I really think he enjoyed it. It's quite a cut up. We discovered after the operation that he missed it by 10%. And the only reason I'm standing before you, humanly speaking, is one of my closest friends on earth sliced me. He hurt me in order to heal me. You see, my friends, you are not primarily concerned about what your children think of you now. You are concerned about what your children are going to think about you 10, 15, 20 years from now. My father was a great disciplinarian. The military man. Very patriotic. He laid down stripes, I saw stars. And I can never remember him once giving me a whipping and having me turn around and say, boy, Dad, thanks a lot for that fresh evidence of your love. Boy, I can remember coming out and going out in the yard and, you know, wait till I get big. Going to my little Eskimo dog who always seemed to understand. You know, and he licked my tears away. I somehow felt that he was the only guy on my team. He and I had talked together about what we were going to do in our conspiracy against these adults. But today I rise up and call my father blessed upon every single remembrance. Oh, how I thank God for a man who loved me enough to say, son, no. And couldn't care less what I thought about it right then. Because he knew what was best for me. Let's come over on the positive side. First of all, impart the expectancy of obedience. You see, some parents never expect their children to disobey, to obey them, and they're seldom disappointed. I built a sandbox, this is speaking very liberally, nailed some wood together, put some sand in it. The goal of the sandbox was right outside my bedroom window where I had my study at the time. And, you know, all of a sudden I hear, Johnny! Window pane. Oh, Johnny sitting out there with Bill. Never move. So Bill says, hey, Johnny, your mother's calling you. You know, as if he needed the information. I said, yeah, I know. Boy, about four or five times, finally the sixth time, Johnny! All the corpses down the street are going to come out. Just as calmly as I'm sitting here, standing here, Johnny turns to Bill and says, I got to go now, Bill. And I thought to myself, Johnny's been down that road before. You ever watch this happen in your own experience? You go into home, it's very relaxed, nobody's uptight, nobody's sitting around like Dresden dolls on a crate of eggs. You know, we're sort of very relaxed, and pop, mom say something, or, you know, the kid gets up and moves over, and you go into another home, you know, where they're yelling their head off, and they're beating the kid to a pulp, and finally come out, you know, I just can't hit him any harder, it hurts me too much.
and still nothing happened. Well, examine it at a deeper level and you'll develop there's a difference at the expectancy level. Second, allow your child to express his viewpoint. See, a lot of discipline is very arbitrary. It's done without a lot of thinking. By the way, that's why the average kid gets hit on the back of the head, the worst place in all of the world to hit him. Tremendous place, 20, 30 inches below. Padded. Because the average person doesn't think, he just immediately whips into action and the closest thing to him is a kid's head. No thought.
I was teaching at the seminary, a wives class at night. It'd been a long day of classes and interviews and faculty meeting, couple committee meeting. By the time I got home, about 8:30, believe me, I was shot. And I walked in the door, clear case of homicide. Two boys into the act. And you discipline the older one, obviously, the more responsible one. And I go into the bedroom, my lovely wife is sitting there, and she says, "Darling, you missed." She says, "Let me tell you what happened before you came." And of course, when she gave me the entire picture, it completely changed it. So I had to do what I think is the hardest thing for a parent to do. And that's to apologize. You ever do that to your child? Well, it takes a lot of time to screw up the courage, Great big you. Here I come. I go out to the kitchen. My boy's still whimpering. I put my arm around him. I said, "Bob, I'm awfully sorry. I really blew it. I just acted too soon. I didn't have all the facts. And I want you to forgive me. Will you forgive me?" "Sure, Dad." Puts his arm around me and says, "That's okay. We all make mistakes." And I thought to myself, you better believe it. The only difference is sometimes it's very hard for us as adults to admit. See, your child is not expecting you to be a perfect parent, but he is expecting you to be an honest one. Secure enough to say, "I was wrong." Third, will you remember discipline as a long-range process? Reason why the average parent is frustrated in the process of discipline is that he can only see it in isolation. He can only tell you what happened today, this hour. And this demands a long-range process. Not only does it demand a long-range process, but a process in which you see your child through a particular set of glasses. And I want to ask you how you see your child. You see your child as a problem? If you do, you know what you'll have the dubious distinction of developing? A problem. Or do you see your child as potential? Not in terms of what he is, but in terms of what he is to become by the grace of God. And how you see your child will very largely determine what your child becomes. You know, it's always been of interest to me, being in the school business, to find that I can only remember two public school teachers I ever had in all my life. One was my fifth grade teacher, Miss Simon, and the other was my sixth grade teacher, Miss Noe. Miss Simon, I'll never forget her. I'm quite convinced she will never forget me. I came into her class, Howard Hendricks. "I understand you're the worst kid in this school." Well, that gave me a reputation to live up to. I knew I was bad, but I didn't know I was that bad. And I wouldn't let her down. Man, did I give that woman fit. Until finally she tied me to my seat with a rope. She tied my hands behind my back and
took mucilage paper, went all the way around from this side to this side. Now, Howard, you will sit still and keep quiet. So what else do you do?
And finally, I was graduated from her class for obvious reasons. And I went into my sixth grade teacher's class, Miss Snowy, 6 feet 4 inches tall. Sort of a feminine version of Sherlock Holmes. Boy, she was a beautiful woman. I used to think if that dear woman had done nothing but just stand erect, she would have done something for you. And I walked in, you know, to look up and introduced myself. She said, Howard Hendricks, I heard a lot about you, and I thought, here we go again. And then she jarred me by saying, but I don't believe a word of it. And my friends, I met the first person in my life who ever convinced me they believed in me. And I'd never let her down. I used to come to that class early. I used to take on special projects for her. I used to run all of her errands. I'd work on my homework so fast to get it through so I'd have more time to spend doing things for her. Because she saw me in terms of a whole new possibility. You know, I've had some fascinating correspondence with this woman. I just ran across her. She's 87 years of age. She had a doctor husband, very prominent surgeon in Philadelphia, walked out the front door and left her with 4 boys that she reared totally. And went to teaching school. And someday, I'm in the process of gaining the data. I'm going to write a book about this woman who has changed so many lives and wrote to me and told me that she found Christ as her Savior after the divorce. And as a little kid, I didn't even have a clue. You know the only thing I remember from her class in terms of unusual things? We used to have a little window in the door. You know, you've seen these things. Principal comes by. Mr. Schmatzkopf comes by. You know, all the biggies. Well, I'd be working like crazy. Every now and then, I'd look over there in the door, and there was Miss Simon, my fifth grade teacher, who had just come to see the thing which was come to pass. You know, there he is, sitting clothed and in his right mind. You know what I wish I could do for every parent? You know what I wish I could do for you? I wish I could put a great big picture of your son or daughter and hang it right around their neck. It's a picture of what they're going to be in about 10, 15, 20 years. To give you some perspective. Because how you see that child may very largely determine what that child becomes. If you see him as a loser, that's what he may become. Are you on his team? Are on his back.